Greetings and Nueva Annular Retributions, my Sigma tactically salubrious listeners, and welcome to this January 2019 Science News Update. I'm your host for this tritely suppositoric science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Instead of Idiot Scientist of the Month this month, I'm instead turning to Idiot Publishers of the Month instead. What insanity am I talking about? Well, I read an article in Wired by one of their staff writers, Joy Ito, and it struck in me a serious chord, especially since the academic publishing industry affects me, well, pretty much every day. So what am I babbling about? Well, as Joy Ito points out, science is built, enhanced, and developed through the open and structured sharing of knowledge, and we can all agree on that. If there isn't open access to knowledge everywhere, then nobody really can make much progress. Yet some publishers charge so much for subscriptions to their academic journals that even the libraries of the world's wealthiest universities cannot afford them. Harvard announced a couple of weeks ago that they can no longer afford the prices, for example. And if Harvard can't afford those prices, what chances do universities like mine have? So those publishers' profit margins rival those of the most profitable companies in the world, even though research is largely underwritten by governments. And publishers don't pay authors, or researchers, or the peer reviewers who evaluate those works. I can vouch for that. How is such an absurd structure able to sustain itself, and how might we change it? When the internet emerged in the 90s, people began predicting a new, more robust era of scholarship based on access to knowledge for all. The web, that had started as a research network, now had an easy-to-use interface and a protocol to connect to all published knowledge, making each citation just a click away. Well, that was all theory. Again, I can speak from personal knowledge of this. Instead, academic publishers started to consolidate. They solidified their grip on the rights to prestigious journals, allowing them to charge for access and exclude the majority of the world from reading research publications, all the while extracting billions in dollars of subscription fees from university libraries and corporations. This meant that some publishers, such as Elsevier, the science, technology, and medicine-focused branch of the RELX Group publishing conglomerate, were able to extract huge profit margins. In the case of Elsevier, in 2017, they were more profitable than Apple, or Google, or Microsoft. And in most scholarly fields, it's the most important journals that continue to be secured behind paywalls, a structure that doesn't just affect the spread of information. Those journals have what we call high impact factors, and those can skew academic hiring and promotions in a kind of self-fulfilling cycle that works like this. Typically, anyone applying for an academic job, again, I know this from experience and the fact that I have been on a number of search committees and chaired them, anybody applying for an academic job is evaluated by a committee and by other academics who write letters of evaluation for them. In most fields, papers published in peer-reviewed journals are a critical part of the evaluation process. And the so-called impact factor, which is based on the citations that a journal gets over time, well, they're important. Evaluators typically are, well, pretty busy academics who may lack a depth of expertise in a candidate's particular research topic, and they are prone to skim the submitted papers and kind of rely heavily on the number of papers published and the impact factors of the journals that they're published in. I know that doesn't seem fair, but they use that as a proxy for the journal prestige and rigor in their assessment of the qualifications of a candidate. And so young researchers are forced to prioritize publications in journals with high impact factors. Faulty as they are, if they want tenure or promotions, they pretty much have to do that. Again, I know this from experience. The consequence is that important work gets locked up behind paywalls and remains largely inaccessible to anybody not in a major research lab or a university who can afford it. This includes taxpayers, who actually funded the research in the first place. It also includes the developing world and the emerging world of non-academic researchers and startup labs who probably shouldn't have access to that stuff anyway, but they don't have access. Ito points to a number of places where publishing is trying to break down those paywalls. First, in 2011, Alexandra Elbakyan started Sci-Hub, a website that provides free access to millions of otherwise inaccessible academic papers. She was based in Kazakhstan, far from the courts where academic publishers could easily bring lawsuits. Elbakyan says that Elsevier's mission was to, quote, make uncommon knowledge common, unquote. And she jokes that she is just trying to help the company do that because it seemed they can't do that themselves. While Elbakyan has been widely criticized for her blatant disregard for copyrights, Sci-Hub has become a popular tool among academics, even at major universities, because it removes the friction of the paywalls and provides links to collaborators beyond the paywalls. Second, the open access process began about 10 years ago, and this is a worldwide effort to make scholarly research literature freely accessible online. Essentially, researchers upload the unpublished versions of their papers to a repository focused on subject matter or operated by an academic institution. The movement was sparked by services like archive.org, which you've heard me mention a number of times on this program. And Cornell started archive.org back in 1991, and it entered the mainstream when Harvard established the first U.S. self-archiving policy in 2008, and other research universities around the world have followed. Third, lots of journals are pretty disgusted with their publishers, which has led to a silent revolution of these journals becoming open access. Of course, if a journal becomes open access and loses that paywall, somebody still has to pay for the articles that are published. Unfortunately, that falls upon schmucks like me. Many of these journals now charge authors publication fees that allow them to stay open access. I was surprised a few months back when one unnamed journal sent me an $800 bill. I asked them what the heck they were thinking, and they explained that I had apparently missed the fact that they were now a pay-to-play journal. They were not when I last published there about 10 years ago. I was not thrilled to say the least, but my article was already published and out there in the public, so at that point they agreed to waive the fee after some serious legal threats from my end, although I suspect the university council would have just agreed to paying them if I had actually gone that far. Anyway, even when you actually have an open access journal, it does not seem that way. Charging authors has actually become a way of life for more recent entries into the journal race, and they have been charging more and more over the last few years. One open access genetics journal that I published in about 10 years ago, they asked for about $400 in charges back then, and now they charge about $1,200 US. At least they were upfront about the charges. So even open access has a price. According to Ito, we should be able to pressure open access publishers to lower their publication charges. He makes a good point that these companies will continue to extract high fees even in an open access world. So far, they have successfully prevented collective bargaining through confidentiality agreements and other legal means. So it makes you question who exactly the idiot is here. Okay, let's get on with the first story of the night. Have you ever wondered where your mitochondria came from? I suspect probably not, even if you thought about your mitochondria at all. The last time you probably thought about your mitochondria was probably when they taught you that it was the powerhouse of the cell in grade school. Cool, powerhouse, make energy, me die without mitochondria. Yes, mitochondria are important, and yes, you die without mitochondria. But what's interesting about them is the evolution of mitochondria and where they might have come from in the first place. Most people never really go beyond make energy. So it always strikes them as amazing when you tell them that mitochondria are a bit of a mystery. They, and chloroplasts, which I won't talk about here, are weird in the organelle family. They have their own DNA, like submicroscopic cells, but they also make their own ribosomal RNA and their own ribosomes. They have their own transfer, tRNA. They make their own mRNA. And they reproduce by binary fission, not like animal or plant cells. Also, bacteria don't have mitochondria, but so-called higher organisms like us do. So if all life evolved from the same common ancestor, which did not have mitochondria, then where'd they come from? Well, the most commonly agreed thought right now of where mitochondria came from is something called the endosymbiont theory. And the theory is this, that once upon a time, billions of years ago, archaea bacteria are larger, more complex bacteria, more similar to human cells, they swallowed up and captured the simpler, smaller type of bacteria called eubacteria. And these were the two earliest forms of life. At first, the smaller bacteria may have lived inside the archaea bacteria as endosymbionts, that is, independent organisms that cooperate with their hosts. The simple bacteria gave its host extra energy in order to grow bigger and get faster and more complex. The host gave the captured eubacteria extra food and kept it alive and happy. Over time, the mitochondria lost many of their genes and eventually became an integral part of the cell and were stuck there inside the archaea bacteria forever. These mixed cells of archaea bacteria plus eubacteria inside became what is known as eukaryotic cells. These cells with a nucleus contain mitochondria and became our most ancient ancestors, and not just for humans, but plants and animals and fungi. And now almost all eukaryotic cells contain mitochondria. However, Dr. Peter Schultz of Scripps Institute insists that if you want to prove something is true in genetics, then you better be able to reproduce it in a laboratory. So Schultz and his colleagues created a hybrid cell. What they did is they fused two lab organisms. And the two lab organisms are baker's yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, and the common gut bacteria that everybody knows, E. coli. The results of this work were reported in the October 2018 issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And none of this was very easy to do, let me tell you. So the way Schultz did it was, they first disabled a gene in the yeast mitochondria so that the organelles couldn't produce chemical energy in the form of adenosine triphosphate, ATP, which you've probably heard of. E. coli were engineered to lack a gene needed to make the B vitamin thiamine, which bacteria need to live. The team also outfitted the bacteria with a transport protein that can move ATP and its precursor, ADP, in or out of the cell. When the bacteria were put inside the yeast cells, the bacteria supplied the ATP the yeast needed to live, and the yeast made thiamine for the bacteria. Now, mind you, it wasn't a perfect arrangement. The yeast kept digesting the bacteria, so Schultz's team equipped the E. coli with a special protein called a snare protein from Chlamydia trachomatis, which can live inside human cells and cause the sexually transmitted disease chlamydia. Snare proteins can prevent a host cell's digestive organelles called lysosome from coming together to dismantle the invading microbes. Snare outfitted E. coli eventually were able to grow inside the yeast cell. The researchers found that the hybrid yeast bacteria grew for more than 40 generations. Now, this is all very cool, but there's no way to know the exact environmental and physiological conditions that microbes face that actually led to the formation of eukaryotic cells 1.5 billion years ago. It seems obvious that exchanging energy for nutrients may have been what pushed the bacteria and the archaea together to join forces, but it was probably more complicated than that. If you think about it, why would the captured bacteria supply ATP to the cell and ship them out? Wouldn't it make more sense for it to just use up all the sugar that it stole from the bigger bacteria and then keep the energy? Why didn't the symbiote end up becoming a parasite? Well, one explanation is that it started out as a parasite, but eventually it lost its ability to live outside the host cell, and it was forced to become an endosymbiote and play fair with the bigger bacteria. This complicated new study may explain how it went from being a parasite to a symbiote. Next story. We follow the continually changing face of the exoplanet search. Yay! So I have been following the exoplanet search for you listeners and myself for the last 6 or 7 years. Every month or two, there's an interesting break, and I report on what is going on in the great black out there. So NASA's Transmitting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, TESS, TESS, was launched in April 2018. And TESS's specialty is to find exoplanets. TESS was designed to be a follow-up to the prolific Kepler Space Telescope, which went dark in October 2018, after about 10 years of observation. Like Kepler, TESS searches for planets by watching for dips in starlight as planets cross, or transit as they call it, in front of their stars. Unlike Kepler, which stared unblinkingly at a single patch of sky for a decade, TESS scans a new segment of sky every month. Over 2 years, TESS will cover the entire 360 degrees of sky visible from the Earth's orbit. In the first 4 segments of his search around our sky, TESS has already spotted 8 confirmed planets and more than 320 unconfirmed candidates. This was reported by Dr. Zhu Chelsea Wang of MIT at the American Astronomical Society meeting in Seattle about 3 weeks ago. At any rate, the findings of TESS are really stirring things up in the extrasolar crowd right now. Why? Well, let's take the third planet found by TESS, HD 21749b. This one is only 52 light years away. It has the lowest temperature found so far for a planet orbiting a bright nearby star. Wang reported this at the meeting. Wang also said that HD 21749b makes a great candidate for follow-up observations with future telescopes like the James Webb Space Telescope, scheduled to launch in 2021. Webb will use starlight filtering through the atmospheres of planets like HD yada yada to measure those atmospheres' properties and search for signs of life. Wang says, quote, "If we want to study atmospheres of cool planets, this is the one to start with," unquote. Of course, to astronomers, cool is a relative term. HD yada yada is still probably too hot and gassy to host life. Its orbit takes 36 Earth days, the longest known orbital period for planets transiting bright stars within 100 light-years of our sun. That leaves it at a distance from the star that should heat the planet's surface to about 150 degrees Celsius, which is too hot for liquid water. We all know water boils at 100 degrees Celsius. And at 2.84 times Earth's size and 23 times Earth's mass, its density suggests it probably has a thick atmosphere, unlike Earth's life-friendly one. Despite its heat, this planet is still, well, tepid compared with most of the scorched worlds whose atmospheres astronomers can probe right now. We talked about TESS's first find, Pi Mensae C, on this podcast back in September 2018. That planet orbits its star every 6.27 days and is about 2.14 times Earth's size and about 5 times Earth's mass, giving it a density similar to pure water. Wang says, quote, "The weirdest thing about Pi Mensae C is the company it keeps. Previous observations showed that the star Pi Mensae also has a planet 10 times the mass of Jupiter that orbits every 5.7 years. That planet, Pi Mensae B, revolves on a wildly eccentric orbit, swinging between the distance of Earth and the distance of Jupiter from its star. That is the most extreme system we know of that has this type of architecture," unquote. The second planet found by TESS, LHS-3844b, has a radius just 1.3 times that of Earth's, but it swings around its planet every 11 hours, giving it a surface temperature of about 540 degrees Celsius. Wang says, quote, LHS-3844b is like a lava world, and probably pretty unpleasant for life, unquote. Wang finishes with this, quote, TESS has completed about 1/12 of its first sky survey, but we are already writing proposals to extend its initial two-year mission. TESS's orbit is held stable by the moon's gravity, so it doesn't need to spend any fuel to stay put. The fuel on board used to change the direction of the telescope points is enough to last for 300 years. We are talking centuries, not decades here, of stability. TESS is really going to be an important part of our astronomical efforts for the next decade and for more to come. Unquote. The next story struck me as interesting for two reasons. First, it seemed very counterintuitive when I first read it, until it was clearly explained. And second, it involves Alzheimer's, and our understanding of how the disease process actually works in Alzheimer's. So my father, who has Alzheimer's, immediately came to mind. So this story came out of the lab of Dr. Eduardo Moreno, the principal investigator of the Cell Fitness Lab at Champlimont Center for the Unknown in Lisbon, Portugal. His paper, published in the journal Cell Reports last month, is entitled, quote, Culling Less Fit Neurons Protects Against Amyloid Beta-Induced Brain Damage and Cognitive and Motor Decline, unquote. So what the heck does that mean? Well, for years, it's been believed by researchers that neuronal cell death in Alzheimer's disease is inevitably detrimental, a finding that could have important therapeutic implications. And if you think about it, it makes sense. Killing neurons in the brain should be considered a bad thing. I mean, if it leads to memory loss and cognitive ability, loss of cognitive ability, it's not that fantastic. However, Moreno's work does suggest something else. His results suggest that a cell quality control process known as cell competition, through which substandard or abnormal cells in the brain and other tissues are eliminated, has a beneficial effect in Alzheimer's, acting to remove toxic peptide-expressing neurons and helping to hold back or protect against disease progression. Tests show that blocking this natural cell culling process in a fruit fly model of Alzheimer's resulted in worse symptoms and accelerated neurodegeneration. Moreno says, quote, Our results suggest that neuronal death is beneficial because it removes neurons that are affected by noxious beta-amyloid aggregates from brain circuits. And having those dysfunctional neurons is worse than losing them. Death of unfit neurons is beneficial, protecting against disease progression by restoring motor and cognitive functions, unquote. So multicellular organisms have evolved mechanisms to help maintain tissue homeostasis and integrity through development and all the way into aging. One of these mechanisms, called cell competition, effectively leads to the selection of the fittest cells in a tissue by enabling a comparison process between neighboring cells. And that leads to the least fit cell, well, undergoing suicide. Cell competition represents a key anti-aging mechanism throughout the body, and particularly in the brain. Moreno's team reasoned that the same cell comparison mechanisms that act to clear substandard cells during normal aging could feasibly be involved in diseases of accelerated aging, like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, or Huntington's. The team's initial study suggested that neuronal expression of amyloid B in the fly's neurons changed the cell's fitness and induced cell elimination. When the researchers then blocked this naturally occurring neuronal fitness process that culls the cells, the animals exhibited worse memory problems, worse motor coordination, and faster neurodegeneration and mortality. In contrast, when the researchers boosted the process of fitness comparison, They sped up the death of unfit neurons, and that seemed to result in the recovery of the Alzheimer's disease amyloid beta-expressing flies. Moreno says, quote, "The flies almost behaved like normal flies with regard to memory formation, locomotive behavior, and learning at a time point when the control Alzheimer flies were already strongly affected," unquote. The researchers' results suggest that cell competition is still active in Alzheimer's and can help to hold back disease progression by eliminating affected neurons. So why is this important? Well, as it turns out, some neurochemical treatments for Alzheimer's actually inhibit the process of cell death. In other words, they block the process of culling that's there to get rid of those most badly affected neurons. And that's not a good thing. It means that we may be making the disease worse with certain treatments because we do not understand the natural processes of cell clearance. If what Moreno is saying is true, then we need to back off and let the brain kill those badly behaving cells. Moreno concludes the article with the following, quote, "Surprisingly, we found that neuronal death had a beneficial effect against beta-amyloid-dependent cognitive and motor decline. This finding challenges the commonly accepted idea that neuronal death is detrimental at all stages of the disease progression. We found that most amyloid-induced neuronal apoptosis is beneficial and likely acts to remove damaged and/or dysfunctional neurons in an attempt to protect neural circuits from aberrant neuronal activation and impaired synaptic transmission," unquote. The last story of the night is about poop. What kind of poop? Well, wombat poop. Now, despite the fact that that does sound like a joke, I'm serious. Your immediate question should be, why would wombat poop be at all of interest to me? Well, my answer would be because wombats are the only animals that we know of that poop in cubes. A couple of months back, in November 2018, this amazing science story was presented at the American Physical Society Division of Fluid Dynamics meeting. It was presented by Dr. David Hugh of Georgia Tech. He found that the varied elasticity of the wombat's intestine helps these marsupials to, quote, "sculpt their scat into cube-like nuggets," unquote, instead of the round pellets, messy piles, or tubular coils made by other mammals. Why bother? Well, apparently, wombats prefer to mark their territories with small piles of stacked scat. Cuboid poop stacks better than round poop, and they don't roll away as easily. But as any biologist will tell you, cubic shapes in nature are very unusual. And if you're going to make cubes, it takes extra energy to make those flat surfaces of those sharp corners. So it's surprising that the wombat's intestines, which pretty much don't look any different than any other mammal's intestines, could create that shape. When an Australian colleague sent Hugh the intestines from two roadkill wombats that were just collecting frost in his freezer, well, Hugh says he, quote, "opened those intestines up like it was Christmas," unquote. Of course, the intestines were packed with poop, which made Hugh even happier. Hugh says that in humans, a poop-filled bit of intestine stretches out slightly. In wombats, the intestine stretches to two or three times its regular width to accommodate all that feces. Hugh used skinny balloons, the type that get sculpted into animals at carnivals, to inflate the intestines and measure that stretchiness in different places. Some regions were more stretchy, some were stiffer. Hugh thinks that the stiffer regions probably help create the distinct edges on the wombat poops as the waste moves through the gut. Sculpting the poop into cuboid nuggets appears to be a finishing touch for the wombat digestive tract. Over a typical 6-meter-long wombat intestine, the poops take on distinct edges only in the last half meter or so. Hugh says that up to that point, the waste is gradually solidifying as it moves through the gut. He also says, quote, the finished turds are especially dry and fibrous, which may help them retain their signature shape. When they're squeezed out, they can be stacked or rolled like dice, standing up on any of their faces. I know, I've tried it, unquote. And let me be the first to say, ew, dice poop? Poop dice? Anyway, the talk reports that in the wild, wombats deposit their droppings on top of rocks or logs as territory markers, sometimes forming small piles, and they seem to prefer to poop in elevated spots, but they're also limited by their stubby legs. To confirm that the elasticity variation really does form the cubes, Hugh is now trying to model the wombat digestive tract using pantyhose. Sure, why not? Pantyhose should work like intestines. Well, that's all for me for now. Happy New Year. Make sure you don't borrow pantyhose from Dr. Hugh. Always ask how much the publication charge is going to be. Let those crappy old brain cells just die out. Keep watching the skies. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.